Farewell. God knows when we shall meet again. I have a faint, cold fear thrills through my veins that almost freezes up the heat of life.
I'll call them back again to comfort me.
Nurse!
What should she do here? My dismal scene I needs must act alone.
Come. You are listening to the voice of Claire Bloom as Juliet in William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, a page from this Sunday's edition of Anthology. This is Fleetwood. Every Sunday at 1, WRCA, in conjunction with the Poetry Center of the YM and YWHA, 92nd Street and Lexington Avenue in Manhattan, brings you transcribed Anthology, a selection of readings from poets past and present, and the music to accompany their poetry. This week, commemorating the birth and death of William Shakespeare, our guests are Claire Bloom, Sir Laurence Olivier, Morris Evans, and Marlon Brando. This week, concurrent with memorial programs on both sides of the Atlantic, the 96th Shakespearean Drama Festival opened at Stratford-on-Avon with Sir John Gielgud's production of Twelfth Night. Sir Laurence Olivier and his wife, Vivian Lee, were starred. It was Sir John's first production of the comedy. Another first this year will be a production of Titus Andronicus, which will be added to the repertoire of the Shakespeare Theater, thereby fulfilling the contract of the company to present all 37 of the playwright's plays. Of the life of Shakespeare, there is very little direct or positive knowledge, his many biographers being dependent on inferences or more or less probability, ranging from practical certainty to conjecture. This much is certain. William Shakespeare, the eldest son and third child of John and Mary Shakespeare, was born at Stratford-on-Avon and baptized on April 26, 1564. He was educated at the Free Grammar School at Stratford. He married Anne Hathaway in 1582, and 3 years later moved to London, where he began his writing career, which down through the years has earned him the enviable reputation of being perhaps the greatest playwright of all times. He died at the age of 52, within 3 days of his birth date, and was buried in Stratford Church, close by the humble family home. It would be an impossibility to touch on all of Shakespeare's many works within the confines of a single edition of Anthology. In fact, we made a survey of the Shakespearean records we have on hand and estimated we would need more than 24 consecutive hours in which to play them in their entirety. Our anniversary program, therefore, must be directed towards one particular phase of the poet's work, and we think it only fitting that we allow the Bard of Avon to set the scene himself in this fashion. Look you yonder. Sir Laurence Olivier, as my Lord Hamlet, doth address his company of players in the courtyard of Elsinore. Hearken, hearken well, for in his words lie portents of the shape of things to come. Yes, hearken well.
Speak the speech, I pray you, as I pronounced it to you, trippingly on the tongue. But if you mouth it, as many of your players do, I had as lief the town crier spoke my lines. No, do not saw the air too much with your hand thus, but use all gently. For in the very torrent, tempest, and as I may say, whirlwind of your passion, you must acquire and beget a temperance that may give it smoothness. Oh, it offends me to the soul to hear a robustious, periwig-pated fellow tear a passion to tatters, to split the ears of the groundlings who, for the most part, are capable of nothing but inexplicable dumb shows and noise. I would have such a fellow whipped. But out Herods, Herods. Pray you avoid it.
I warrant your honor.
Be not too tame, neither, but let your own discretion be your tutor. Suit the action to the word to the action, with this special observance that you o'erstep not the modesty of nature. For anything so overdone is from the purpose of playing, whose end, both at the first and now, was and is to hold as 'twere the mirror up to nature, to show virtue her own feature, scorn her own image, and the very age and body of the time, his form and pressure. Now this, overdone, though it make the unskillful laugh, cannot but make the judicious grieve, the censure of which one must, in your allowance, outweigh a whole theatre of others. Oh, there be players that I have seen play, and heard others praise, and that highly, not to speak it profanely, that having neither the accent of Christian, nor the gait of pagan, Christian, nor man, have so strutted and bellowed that I have thought that some of nature's journeymen have made men and not made them well. They imitated humanity so abominably.
I hope we have reformed that indifferently with us, sir.
Oh, reform it altogether? And let those that play your clowns speak no more than is set down for them. For there be of them that will themselves laugh to set on some barren quantity of spectators to laugh to, though in the meantime some necessary question of the play be then to be considered. That's villainous, and shows the most pitiful ambition in the fool that uses it. Go, make you ready.
We are well prepared, my Lord Hamlet, and I'm sure many of you have already detected the premise of our plot for this week's program in commemoration of the birth and death of William Shakespeare. Among the playwright's tragedies, comedies, and histories, there is many a speech to be spoken trippingly on the tongue, and we intend to have three of them spoken for you by three well-known Shakespearean actors and actresses of England and America. If you have an anthology of the Bard of Avon's plays on hand, you might enjoy following the monologues we've chosen, matching your interpretation of the lines with the interpretations of our various stars. We'll identify the play, the act and scene, before the monologue is given. For our first speech, may we refer you to Romeo and Juliet, Act 4, Scene 3, Juliet's Chambers. Juliet is played by Claire Bloom of the Old Vic Company. To many of us as the potion scene, the touching Shakespearean monologue which follows is delivered by Juliet just before she drinks the vial given her by Friar Lawrence. Although she has been told it will only make her appear that she is dead, Juliet is afraid that the potion may be a real poison. Lady Capulet kisses her daughter and walks from the room. She is followed by Juliet's nurse, who quietly shuts the door. Juliet takes a step towards the door. She raises her hand, half in farewell, half in a gesture to call them back.
Farewell. God knows when we shall meet again. Oh. I have a faint, cold fear thrills through my veins that almost freezes up the heat of life.
I'll call them back again to comfort me. Nurse! What should she do here? My dismal scene I needs must act alone.
Come, vial. What if it be a poison which the friar subtly hath ministered to have me dead? Lest in this marriage he should be dishonored.
because he married me before to Romeo. I fear it is. Oh, and yet, methinks I should not, for he hath still been tried a holy man. How if, when I am laid into the tomb, I wake before the time that Romeo come to redeem? There's a fearful point. Shall I not then be stifled in the vault, to whose foul mouth no healthsome air breathes in, and there die strangled ere my Romeo come? Or if I live, is it not very like the horrible conceit of death and night, together with the terror of the place, as in a vault, an ancient receptacle, where for these many hundred years the bones of all my buried ancestors are packed, where bloody Tybalt, yet but green in earth, lies festering in his shroud, where, as they say, at some hours of the night, spirits resort. Alack, is it not like that I, so early waking, what with loathsome smells and shrieks, like mandrakes torn out of the earth, that living mortals, hearing them, run mad? Oh, if I live, shall I not be distraught, environed with all these hideous fears? Madly play with my forefather's joints, and pluck the mangled Tybalt from his shroud, and in this rage, with some great kinsman's bone as with a club, dash out my desperate brain. Look, methinks I see my cousin's ghost seeking out Romeo, that did spit his body upon a rapier's point. Scared him on day! Romeo, I come. This do I drink to thee.
From a chamber in a home in fair Verona, we turn now to a prison cell in a castle called Pomfret, and from a story of young romance and tragedy to the history of an English king. In Shakespeare's King Henry IV, there is a familiar line which might well serve as a preface to the scene we are about to hear. The line, "Uneasy lies the head that wears a crown." For further reference, our play is Richard II, Act 5, Scene 5. King Richard is portrayed by Morris Evans. A major achievement on the stage, a stunning triumph on television, Richard II is one of Morris Evans' finest portrayals. The monologue we have chosen for this week's special Shakespearean program occurs during the final moments of the play. The scene, a prison cell in Pomfret Castle, where Richard has been imprisoned, a cell in which he is soon to die at the hands of Bolingbroke's paid assassins. In these, his final moments, the king muses upon his prison and upon the circumstances which have led to his downfall, and soon to his death. He speaks.
I have been studying how I may compare this prison where I live unto the world. And for because the world is populous, and here is not a creature but myself, I cannot do it. Yet I'll hammer it out. My brain I'll prove the female to my soul the father, and these two beget a generation of still-breeding thoughts. And these same thoughts people this little world, in humors like the people of this world, for no thought is contented. The better thoughts, as thoughts of things divine, are intermixed with scruples, and to set the word itself against the word, as thus, come, little one. For then again, it is as hard to come as for a camel to thread the postern of a small needle's eye. Thoughts tending to ambition. How these do plot unlikely wonders. How these vain, weak nails may tear a passage through the flinty ribs of this hard world, my ragged prison walls. And for they cannot die in their own pride. Thoughts tending to contempt flatter themselves that they are not the first of fortune's slaves, nor shall not be the last. Like silly beggars, that sitting in the stocks refuge their shame that many have and others must sit there. And in this thought, they find a kind of ease, bearing their own misfortunes on the backs of such as have before endured the like. Thus play I in one person, many people, and none contented. Sometimes I am a king, then treasons make me wish myself a beggar, and so I am. Then crushing penury persuades me I was better when a king. Then am I kinged again, and by, think that I am unkinged by Bolingbroke, and straight am nothing. But whate'er I be, not I, not any man, that but man is, with nothing shall be pleased till he be eased with being nothing. Music do I hear. Hucky time. How sour sweet music is when time is broken, no proportion kept. So is it with the music of men's lives. For here have I the daintiness of ear to check time broken in disordered strings. But for the concord of my state and time, and not an ear to hear my true time broke, I wasted time, and now does time waste me. For now hath time made me his numbering clock. My thoughts are minutes, and with sighs they jar their watches on unto mine eyes, the outward watch, whereto my finger like a dial's point is pointing still in cleansing them from tears. Now, sir, the sound which tells what hour it is are clamorous groans which strike upon my heart, which is the bell. So sighs and tears and groans show minutes, times, and hours. But my time runs posting on in Bolingbroke's proud joy, while I stand fooling here, his jack of a clock. This music mads me. Let it sound no more. For though it hath holp madmen to their wits, in me it seems it will make wise men mad. Yet blessing on his heart that gives it me, for 'tis a sign of love, and love to Richard is a strange brooch in this all-hating world.
The Death of a King, Richard II, played by Morris Evans. Our final monologue concerns the death of a man who wished to be a king. The play, Julius Caesar, Act 3, Scene 3. Our star, Marlon Brando, winner of this year's Academy Award for his vivid, realistic role in On the Waterfront. We'll listen to Marlon Brando as Mark Anthony. The chief cause that made Caesar mortally hated among certain of the Romans was his insatiable desire to be named king. Warned by a soothsayer to beware the Ides of March, warned again by an ill-omened dream suffered by his wife, Caesar nevertheless goes to the Senate upon that fateful day and is slain by his conspirators. Now, on the steps of the Forum, Mark Antony shows Caesar's murdered body to the assembled crowd. Mark Antony speaks in Caesar's honor.
The corpse of Caesar, and let me show you him that made the will. Shall I descend, and will you give me leave? If you have tears, prepare to shed them now. You all who know this mantle, I remember the first time ever Caesar put it on. It was on a summer's evening in his tent that day he overcame the Nervii. Cassius dagger through. See what a rent the envious Casca made. Through this, the well-beloved Brutus stabbed. And as he plucked his cursed steel away, mark how the blood of Caesar followed it. As rushing out of doors to be resolved, if Brutus so unkindly knocked on now. For Brutus, as you know, was Caesar's angel. Judge, oh ye gods, how dearly Caesar loved him. This was the most unkindest cut of all. For when the noble Caesar saw him stab in gratitude, more strong than traitor's arms quite vanquished him. Then burst his mighty heart, and in his mantle, muffling up his face, even at the base of Pompey's statue, which all the while ran blood, great Caesar fell. Oh, what a fall was there, my countrymen. And I, and you, and all of us fell down. Whilst bloody treason flourished over us. Now you weep. And I perceive you feel the dint of pity. These are gracious drops. Kind souls, what weep you when you but behold our Caesar's vesture wounded? Look you here. Here is himself, martyred, you see, with traitors.
Oh, noble Caesar.
A most bloody sight.
We will be revenged.
That's not a traitor live. Stay, countrymen. Good friends. Sweet friends, let me not stir you up to such a sudden flood of mutiny. They that have done this deed are honorable. What private griefs they have, alas, I know not, that made them do it. They are wise and honorable and will no doubt with reasons answer you. I come not, friends, to steal away your hearts. I am no orator as Brutus is. But as you know me all, a plain, blunt man that loved my friend. And that they know full well that gave me public leave to speak of him. But I have neither wit nor words nor worth, action nor utterance nor the power of speech to stir men's blood. I only speak right on. I tell you that which you yourselves do know. Show you sweet Caesar's wounds. Poor, poor dumb mouths, and bid them speak for me. But were I Brutus, and Brutus Antony, there were an Antony would ruffle up your spirits and put a tongue in every wound of Caesar that should move the stones of Rome to rise in mutiny.
We'll not leave us the house of Brutus.
Yes, hear me, countrymen. Yes, hear me speak. Why, friends, you go to do you know not what? Wherein hath Caesar thus deserved your love? Alas, you know not.
I must tell you then, you forgot the will I told you of. Here is the will, and under Caesar's seal, to every Roman citizen he gives, to every several man, 75 drachmas. Left you all his walks, his private arbors and new planted orchards on this side Tiber. He hath left them you and to your heirs forever. Common pleasures to walk abroad and recreate yourselves. Here was a Caesar. When comes such another?
Never, never!
We would like to thank Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, producers of Julius Caesar, for their kind permission to use a portion from the soundtrack of the picture this week on our special anthology program in commemoration of the birth and death of William Shakespeare, April 1564, April 1616.